The title of this is I am comparing passages in Exodus and John. This class is one of those that I've been thinking about for quite a while, so I'm happy to share it for the first time in person. I guess an alternative title is I Am Back, 2.5 years later. What a life. So a bit of an introduction here. As you probably know, Exodus 3:14 and John 8:58 are often compared to one another in broader Christian tradition. Many translations, in fact, some of which you're holding right now, will capitalize in John 8:58 there, the I am that Jesus says. And it's often pointed out as this declaration of the name of God by Jesus through reference to the declaration to Moses in the burning bush. Honestly, this one is one of the more frustrating arguments I think I've come across, mostly because in a vacuum, these verses are not obviously connected. In context, applying it is very confusing, and the language really just doesn't allow for it. And so that's why I made this class, to hopefully show all of these things. I'm really curious here to show what these verses are actually saying, which interpretation or interpretations are most likely to be true. Are these two verses related whatsoever? And how have views of these verses shifted over time? So the overview here of this class is, first, we're going to consider Exodus 3:14 and the relevant interpretations. What is God saying here is our main focus. Second, we'll be looking at John 8:58 and the relevant interpretations. We're figuring out what Jesus is saying here, and is there any connection here to Exodus 3:14? My main argument that I'll be presenting, if you take nothing else away, Exodus 3:14 is more of a vague statement that's meant to be an unexpected answer to what Abraham is questioning him about. John 8:58 is an emphatic statement of Jesus being the Messiah, not God. And Exodus 3:14 and John 8:58 are not connected in any meaningful way. And with that, I'll provide some background here on Exodus 3. So a lot of the previous book, Genesis, here deals with the relationship of God with the with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob for a large portion of that, and their descendants. There are promises that have been made to these leaders of the nation of Israel, and this new nation would be God's chosen people. Genesis ends with the death of Joseph and the children of Israel living within Egypt. This new nation of Israel, the descendants of Abraham, had lived as sojourners and slaves for hundreds of years, especially in Egypt, because a new leader came about that did not know them. Hebrew children were killed, and out of the massacre arose Moses. Moses, however, fled from Egypt, and God, at the end of Exodus 2 here, has heard the cry of the nation of Israel, and he's going to rectify this solution. So that's the whole background to Exodus 3 here. So this is one of the first of three prophetic visions of Moses: the fire, then an angel, then the presence of God. Some authors interpret this as a gradual revelation of Moses to help him handle seeing the light, so it did not consume him. God first introduces himself to Moses properly in Exodus 3, verse 6, which he says to him, he said, "I am God of your father, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob." And so God is quite clear following that what he wants with Moses. He knows that his people are suffering. He wants to rescue them, and he will rescue them. He's going to bring them to a great land. And guess what, Moses? You're the man for the job. And so this must have been a hefty order placed at the feet of Moses here. Moses holds two serious questions in his mind when presented with this information. His first question, in the following verse here, Moses replied to God, "Who am I that I should go to Pharaoh and that I should take the children of Israel out of Egypt?" And so God provides a response that I don't think Moses was quite expecting. And he said, "For I shall be with you, and this is your sign that I have sent you. When you take the people out of Egypt, you will serve God on this mountain." Well, translation here is just what qualifies you is that I shall be with you. And so Moses really here, his question getting at the heart of it is he's uncertain of what really qualifies him in particular to go on the behalf of God. He did not live with the children of Israel. He lived in the household of Pharaoh, and he fled the people. And so what about him in particular makes him uniquely qualified? And we often carry similar insecurities about ourselves, which positions we might find ourselves in life. And it stems from the meekness of Moses. Moses, of course, being one of the meekest people in the recorded in Scripture. But by the time that God has chosen you to do something, you are already more than qualified. God's plan extends from the beginning. And certainly this is an unanticipated answer. It has nothing to do with Moses. It has everything to do with that God has chosen him. And so now Moses levies a second question. Moses said to God, "Behold, when I come to the children of Israel and say to them, 'The God of your forefathers has sent me to you,' and they say to me, 'What is his name?' What shall I say to them?" So God provides what I will say is another unexpected response. "God answered Moses, 'I shall be as I shall be.' And he said, 'So shall you say to the children of Israel, I shall be has sent me to you.' God said further to Moses, 'So shall you say to the children of Israel, Yahweh, the God of your forefathers, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, has dispatched me to you. This is my name forever.'" And so translation here, Moses, his question gets to the heart at, he feels that God's introduction in verse 6 here is a bit vague. In Exodus 3:6, God refers to himself as Elohi, which is a vague term. Many men, for example, are called Elohim or mighty ones in the Old Testament, including Moses himself in a few chapters from here. Moses should know who this God is based on the rest of Exodus 3:6. It's the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, who is Yahweh. But Moses really asks for a name, really, so he can prove himself to the people that he has been truly sent from God. So Exodus 3:14 here in the Hebrew, what does it exactly mean? The exact phrase is Ehyeh Asher Ehyeh, which means "I am what I am" in most Christian translations. "I will be what I will be" in the complete Jewish Bible. "I shall be what I shall be" in the Art Scroll Tanakh. "I will ever be what I now am" in the Koran Tanakh. The Hebrew here is a bit ambiguous. It can mean multiple things here. But the future focused language of this phrase is preferred by some Jewish scholars. In the Greek translation, the Septuagint is a translation of the Old Testament by 70 Jewish scholars, which is why you often see the abbreviation in the Roman numerals LXX or 70. They translate the name here as Ego Ami Hon, or "I am the being." And then the second name to be given to the people was Hon, or just "the being." And you might be a bit confused why this is translated thus, but it carries a specific meaning in sort of a Greek philosophical language of Middle Platonism, which is to imply an eternal, uncaused being. So this is something that when the Jews are trying to explain God to Greeks, they try to use this language, which is more akin to what they already understood. And then finally, the Latin Vulgate here. The Latin Vulgate is a translation of the Bible into Latin by Jerome in about 382. Mostly, it's really complicated. They translate the name here as Ego Sum Qui Sum, or just "I am who I am," which is kind of interesting because most English translations say "I am what I am." The second name to be given to the people was Qui Est, or just "He who is." So there are a lot of interesting things here, but how have people really interpreted this passage, which is something that I was kind of curious about. Philo here is a Greek Jew that lived in Alexandria about the same time as Jesus's ministry. He favored the Septuagint, and his main goal here is to say that Exodus 3:14 is showing God is a self-existent God, and all beings come from him. View is mostly imported here from this Middle Platonism of the Greeks. because Philo's main goal was to promote Judaism in a language that the Greek upper class would not mock him for. He also goes further to suggest that no name can properly describe God, which is the point of this phrase, and that this God is this eternal being that's contingent on nothing, so he is the ultimate being. John Chrysostom here is a prolific Christian author that lived in Anatolia in the 4th century. The only people that outmatch him in writing is Origen and Augustine. He also favors the Septuagint as well as the Latin Vulgate to suggest God is this eternal being. And this view is, again, mostly imported from this Greek philosophical language of Middle Platonism. And so God here is eternal and uncontingent. He stands alone. Now from a Jewish perspective here, from Rashi, who's a medieval French rabbi who you may have heard of before, wrote extensive commentary on the Tanakh, or just the Jewish Bible, the Old Testament. Ehia Asha Ehia is just to announce that God will not only be with this people in their current sorrows, but also their future sorrows. So the ambiguity here is a present and a future tense. The single Ehia is to announce to the people that it's just the current burdens as to not burden them with future sorrows. Moses is made aware of the future, but he's not relaying it yet. Most authors really seem to suggest that God is claiming to be eternal here. Others use a language of contingency. And so self-descriptive language from God, we could imagine, would have these elements, but is that really the point of what this is trying to get across? And we may have jumped the gun here. So a contextual explanation of what's going on here. Moses is asking the question because he believes Elohi or God is vague. Different gods had different names that were referencing their dominions or what they had dominion over. So like Hadad, which is a common god that would be worshipped by the Canaanites, just means thunderer. And of course, he had dominion over thunder and rain. Geb is an Egyptian god who had dominion over earth, and his name means earth. And so God really in this context is providing another unanticipated answer to Moses. I don't work like this. Whatever I am or will be is what I am or will be. I am not, therefore, to be questioned like this. Further, we should look up at the following verse because this actually answers Moses' question. He said, I am the God of your father, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob in Exodus 3:6. He clarifies, so shall you say to the children of Israel, Yahweh, the God of your forefathers, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, has dispatched me to you. This is my name forever. Moses almost universally, from this point forward, uses Yahweh when saying who he is speaking on the behalf of, not Ehia, not Elohi, but Yahweh. Moses did not take Ehia to be the name of God, and neither should we. If these other attributes are intended by God, these are probably secondary points. But the main answer to Moses' question is the following verse, not this one. So with that in mind, we'll move into some background for John 8 here. The Gospel of John typically is thought to differ from the other three in the fact that it's more abstract to reveal higher spiritual truths. John consistently speaks in the language of new creation as well as the language and plan of God. Jesus in John's mind is the penultimate part of this plan. After all, he is the Messiah. Through Jesus, we become heirs of promise. And so these are all points in the back of John's mind in his gospel here. And so this gospel also contains really long dialogues between the Jews who are really confused or off put by what Jesus has to say. And this confusion is used to preach higher truths to those who will listen. John 8 here comes in two parts, which happen in or near the Second Temple. The dialogue regarding the women caught in adultery, which is the first 11 verses, and then the long commentary between Jesus and the Pharisees and in the crowd of Jews, which is the next following verses. Jesus makes a lot of I am claims throughout John. There are roughly, in my count, 10 that are unique. In John 8, we see, I am the light of this world. I am from above. I am the Son of Man / the Messiah. These are three ones that he claims here, which are part of the 10 unique ones. There are other ones such as I am the door, I am the vine, and likewise. The last half of this chapter is really just a debate about origin. The Pharisees claim to be sons of Abraham and sons of God. Jesus responds, well, if you are, why aren't you acting like it? That's his main contention with them. The Jews said to him, now we know that you have a demon. Abraham died, as did the prophets. Yet you say, if anyone keeps my word, he will never taste death. Are you greater than our father Abraham, who died and the prophets died? Who do you make yourself out to be? The Jews here are really missing the point of what Jesus is trying to get across in the previous verses. Through Jesus, we become children of God and heirs to promise. Otherwise, we die in our sins. And he's trying to get this across. And many did believe on him, but the Pharisees were adamantly opposed to him and consistently wanted to stone him, as is mentioned in the previous passages. Jesus answers their charge here with, if I glorify myself, my glory is nothing. It is my Father who glorifies me, of whom you say he is our God, but you have not known him. I know him. If I were to say that I do not know him, I would be a liar like you. But I do know him, and I keep his word. Your father Abraham rejoiced that he would see my day. He saw it and was glad. What Jesus is responding to them with is on two different levels. Your father God glorifies me. Your father Abraham saw this glory in the past that was to come and was glad. In total, you follow neither of your acclaimed fathers. So the Jews said to him in response, you are not yet 50 years old, and have you seen Abraham? This response really obviously misses the point of what Jesus was just trying to say. Abraham saw the day of Jesus, not the other way around. They're presupposing here a physical viewing, and really they are only interested here in making him look silly to the crowd. They're not really expecting a good response to this. So this grandstanding of the Jews to mock Jesus is then used to reveal a higher truth to them. That is, Jesus said to them, truly, truly, I say to you, before Abraham was, I am. We can also read this as, I am before Abraham was, or I am before Abraham was born, or I am before Abraham existed. All are reasonable translations of the Greek here. The word here for I am, of course, ego eimi, and it's a very common New Testament phrase that appears 211 times. And so really curious here how others have interpreted Jesus. So the argument of Jesus as the divine name in terms of the I am, this is a popular modern Trinitarian argument. The phrases in Exodus 3:14 and John 8:58 are similar at first glance. Is that a coincidence? Some translations even capitalize both to draw on the obvious connection. And the Jews try to stone him for claiming to be God so openly. There are many issues with this sort of argument. John was written in the Greek, and Old Testament draw upon the Septuagint, which would be what was available to the Gentiles at that time. If Jesus was using the divine name, he would say, ego mi hoon, I am the being, or just the being. Neither phrase here is found, so it's unlikely that's what John is saying here. The Latin Vulgate also differs. Neither of the phrases that we'd expect if Jesus was claiming this are used. Historically as well, this argument is fairly new, which was kind of the most surprising thing about doing the investigation into this. I was looking at, this is the Cantia Aurea, which is compiled by a Christian philosopher in the Middle Ages, Thomas Aquinas, and it's an attempt to create a coherent 4th century Christian interpretation of scriptures. It's a good litmus test to see what was considered orthodoxy post-Nicaea. The main argument that the authors here are suggesting is that the I am is proof of being divine in the sense that divine beings have no past or future, but present. Basically, their argument is Jesus uses the present tense here, therefore he's eternal. Kind of a weird argument. I didn't find any divine name arguments, and I actually just started following the English translations because I thought maybe this is a language issue. Doesn't show up in the Wycliffe Bible or the Tyndale Bible or the King James Bible or the Douay Rheims Bible or Webster's Revised King James Bible or Young's Literal Bible or the English Revised Bible, Revised Standard Edition. First occurrence I find is actually the Amplified Bible, which I think there are folks here that are older than this translation of the Bible, which shows you just how new this kind of argument is. The Amplified uses I am to suggest Jesus is claiming to be Yahweh in the broader commentary. So it's a fairly new one, which was quite surprising. So basically, from my viewpoint here, it's grammatically and historically not possible that this is what is being used here. In context, it's also quite suspect. But it would be like equivalent of saying before Abraham was Jesus. Like you place any name there, it doesn't make sense. You could swap it around. It just doesn't quite make sense. And the Cantia Rea points to a more common Trinitarian understanding, which is what you would hear if you talk to a Catholic, that it's not a divine name, more just a claim of eternality. John Chrysostom also has this sort of viewpoint. He says that Jesus here is proving himself greater than Abraham. Both Abraham and the Father glorify Jesus, but the Jews think of him as a lowly carpenter's son. The I am is ambiguous eternal language, like in Exodus 3:14, though he does not make the direct connection. To John, this really, the further John, not John, the one who wrote the gospel, this proves that Christ is co-eternal with the Father. And it shows really, yeah, the general thoughts about this passage of Trinitarians post-Nicaea. So what about this argument as Jesus as eternal? I feel like this just reads a lot into a two-word phrase. It's like if you read the philosophical context of the Greek hoon back into the Hebrew and then translate it back into Greek is what you'd need to do to get this sort of understanding. Jesus is spoken of in past and future contexts, even by Jesus and God, including Genesis 3:15, John 1:15, a few verses ago. So it's not quite clear that any time someone uses the present tense ego me, they're making a divine claim. And phrase is so common, it would imply other people are eternal, like the man born blind, who also says ego me. And I think this is just generally more of a misreading of original Hebrew. As mentioned, dehia is ambiguous. It can be used for future contexts, as the vast majority of the usage is future focus. I think it's usually translated as become. So that's an interesting one. The philosophical context here only really exists in the Greek. It's not in the original Hebrew. The being, hoon, carries, again, that baggage, which ehia asha ehia does not. And then we have to answer, well, why then would the Jews stone Jesus? Reading the next verse here. So they picked up stones to throw at him, but Jesus hid himself and went out of the temple. It's not stated why they wanted to stone him. Capital punishment was banned at this time, but certainly happened. Josephus writes about the stoning of Jesus's own brother in 62 AD. Sometimes they, this is an interesting one. In lieu of stoning, sometimes they would throw people off of cliffs to achieve similar results. And that pricked my memory of Luke 4, where the mob tries to throw Jesus off a cliff for offending them by suggesting the Gentiles in the times of Elijah and Elisha were shown these mercies when there were Jews of the same variety trying to get at the Gentiles are also equal heirs to a promise, and they did not like to hear that. The Pharisees also try to stone him for claiming to be God's son in John 10. And that one's really interesting because he emphatically claims to not be God in that verse. They also stone Stephen and Paul for preaching about Jesus. And we're told many nameless were stoned for a variety of reasons. Probably the most common reason is they just offended the people they were talking to. Finally, the other one that I've seen before is Jesus as pre-existent. This is favored amongst certain other Unitarians, like Jehovah's Witnesses. Jesus was before Abraham, so they did meet each other in Genesis, and they'll point to Genesis 15, I believe. imply this is just a straight, this just implies it's a straight answer that I did see Abraham because I pre-existed him. Again, an interesting one here is actually the word used to describe Abraham was genestai, which implies a birth or creation in a past tense sense. Ego and me does not really carry the same implication to it. We'd expect then the phrasing to be here, I was before Abraham was, if this was a claim about pre-existence, which is not what's said in text. So what are we left with? What are some of the other options? So the previous interpretations to me range from unlikely to impossible. When Jesus is using ego and me, he's referring to himself to something else, either directly or in context throughout John. Without context, he's usually using ego and me to identify as the Messiah, to say, I am he, the Messiah. So the first time is to the Samaritan at the well, twice here now in John 8, and then John 13, 19. And that one's actually interesting because that's the closest in grammatical construction to John 8:58 is John 13, 19. The word, again, used to describe Abraham is genestai, which is, again, implying this birth or creation. What's interesting is there's a note in some of the word usage here that implies that genestai can be used to describe creation at a time in lieu in line with the eternal plan, which has always existed. Jews believed, in a sense, they pre-existed their births. Not physical, but they're always present in the plan of God. In Jeremiah, we read, in Jeremiah 1:5, before I formed you in the womb, I knew you. And before you were born, I consecrated you. I appointed you a prophet to the nations. As well, we can see the plan of God in a past tense sense here. The Lord chose me, David, before your father, Saul. Obviously, in terms of a timeline, no, Saul was king before David, but this is in line with the eternal plan of God. The Jews also, another option here, the Jews also charged Jesus as claiming to be greater than Abraham. So to the Jews here, being a child of Abraham was to be this heir of promise. Jesus consistently tells them that they are not heirs of promise because of their deeds and their spirits. So what really drives them? They're rather heirs of death. They are sons of Satan. Before here, so before, the word before here could mean Jesus is trying to speak about rank. Maybe Jesus is saying, I'm a higher rank than Abraham. So how could we understand this in the passage? So we could understand Jesus is saying here, I'm the Messiah, part of the eternal plan of God before Abraham was born into this world as part of that plan. This is how he was foreseen. This is how he has foreseen my day and why he was glad. I am the heir of his promises and the savior of mankind. We could also read here, I say to you, I am one who is of higher status than Abraham was. So before here again in the sense of rank and being glorified by Abraham and the Father could imply that. So really in my mind here, going back to just the connections here, I think Exodus 3:14 is a bit overblown in its importance due to later philosophy that has been added on top of it. Exodus 3:15 is the more important part of God's answer to Moses. There's really no obvious connection to me between these bits of text. The language doesn't match, and it really doesn't make sense in context. There might be a loose connection in the sense that overall we're talking about the plan of God and this eternal plan, but there's not really a direct connection. But yeah, it's clearly not the point of either here. It appears really this divine name argument that we've probably heard of before is a uniquely English invention, which I apologize to the world for that one. It's unclear how the accounting of the Hebrew and Greek caused this sort of confusion. Most Trinitarians favor really this eternal declaration, but I again think this is highly suspect. It's a terrible proof text, and I think this is the take home from a Unitarian perspective here. It's quite clear the emphatic language of the New Testament is that Jesus is the Messiah. If there were proof texts that really proved Jesus was God, we'd read in plain text, I am God, which you never see. A reading here where Jesus is declaring himself the Messiah again is the most likely interpretation. And then I think there are probably two possible interpretations, which I outlined before. That is everything I have.